So if you dropped a completely random, like frankly stupid phrase into your friend group today, what are the odds that your entire hometown would be repeating it a year from now?
I mean, you probably think the odds are zero, right?
Right. You aren't a celebrity, you aren't an influencer, you're just a normal person who went home for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But biology dictates that the odds are actually surprisingly high because humans are fundamentally hardwired to be infected by the behaviors, the accents, the habits of the people in their immediate vicinity.
It really is this ultimate invisible force.
Yeah.
We all think we're these fiercely independent creatures, you know, totally in control of our own thoughts and our trajectories, but we are essentially just constantly mirroring the environment around us to survive socially. And if you don't control that
The
environment,
environment controls you,
exactly.
which honestly is the core of what I deal with every single day. As a leadership development coach, my whole job is helping adults audit their daily habits,
Yeah.
the standards they hold themselves to, and really the personal environments they've built. And I can tell you, when we audit a business, it's easy. It's spreadsheets, bank statements.
Right, it's completely objective.
Yeah, it's objective. But when I ask a client to critically evaluate the people they spend their time with, oh man, suddenly those clear numbers turn into this messy emotional web of history and guilt. The pushback is immediate.
Oh, I see the exact same friction. So, my work as a career mentor and a community builder, it centers heavily on how intentionally curating your network alters the trajectory of your life. Being willing to move for the right opportunities, seeking out mutual mentorship, these aren't just like feel-good networking concepts. Who you surround yourself with is the literal architecture of your future. But people feel a tremendous amount of guilt when you ask them to evaluate their friends.
They really do. Which brings us to our mission for you today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are pulling our insights today exclusively from Chapter 16 of the book Laws of Life, Book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirko.
It's a fantastic chapter.
It is, and the central law of this chapter is incredibly provocative. It states, keep your true friends to people who you want to be a little more like in some way. So we're going to unpack how to curate your inner circle, why it's necessary for your growth, and how to do it without being cruel or just purely transactional.
Because that's the trap people fall into, right?
Yeah.
Thinking it's transactional. Spirko actually grounds this entire premise in that famous concept from Jim Rohn, the idea that you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with.
Right.
He also points back to Seneca, who advised associating with those who will make a better person of you. But before we get into the mechanics of auditing our friendships, we really need to understand why the people around us shape us so dramatically.
Yeah, let's go back to that random phrase I mentioned at the beginning. Spirko gives this really vivid, real-world example of how insidious social influence is. So back in 1992, he was serving in the army. And in his military unit, the guys had started using this ridiculous phrase, if you're scared, say you're scared.
Right, like a macho thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They'd use it whenever someone hesitated or, did something that seemed weak. So he takes a couple of weeks of leave, goes home to Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and hangs out with his high school buddies. And he says this phrase maybe once or twice in casual conversation.
Which seems entirely harmless. I mean, he's just using the slang of his daily life.
Yeah, exactly. Fast forward a year later, he finishes his enlistment, moves back to Pottsville, and he is suddenly hearing this exact phrase dozens of times. Uttered by his friends, sure, but also uttered by people in the town he barely even knew.
It's crazy.
He just dropped a phrase into a social circle, and it spread like a behavioral virus.
Well, and the context of him being in the military is actually vital to understanding how this works. Because Spirko points out that in a military unit, this concept of becoming more like those around you is basically put on steroids.
Oh,
It's literally called uniformity. Everyone dresses, exercises, eats, talks, and like even folds their underwear the exact same way. That intense, high-pressure environment just accelerates our natural human tendency to adopt the social norms of the pack.
I often compare our social environment to secondhand smoke.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, you don't have to be actively smoking to inhale it. You just have to be in the room long enough, and it gets into your lungs. But I do want to push back on this a little bit. Is this mirroring actually hardwired into our biology? Or is this just a phase? Like, kids go through peer pressure, sure, but as independent adults, don't we eventually outgrow the need to blindly copy our friends?
You'd think so, but Spirko argues vehemently that it never stops. Like, this is a DNA-level survival mechanic.
Really?
Yeah, we are categorized biologically as social animals. Adapting to the traits and characteristics of those around us is our primary means of making communities function. It creates cohesion.
Right, like tribe survival.
Exactly. If you don't fit in with the tribe, historically, you get cast out and you just don't survive. It's a drive that is often stronger than genetics and sometimes even stronger than family bonds.
He actually uses language acquisition to prove how powerful that environmental override is, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. Think about children of immigrant parents. The parents might have a very thick accent from their native country, and the family might speak that native language fluently at home.
Mm-hmm.
But because those children spend the vast majority of their waking hours with other American children at school, they end up speaking English with a regional American accent.
Yeah, it completely overwrites it.
Totally. They adopt a Southern drawl in Texas or a, you know, Yuzu's guy's inflection in the Northeast, completely overriding the linguistic environment of their own parents.
Okay, the Peppa Pig example in the text is hilarious, but also kind of terrifying.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So Spurko's 3-year-old granddaughter started watching Peppa Pig on YouTube. Suddenly she's walking around saying, "Hand me that torch, I can't see," pronouncing "can't" like "cunt" with the full British accent.
Which is just so funny to picture.
Right? She even started calling her parents mommy and daddy like a British child.
It's hilarious, but it really exposes the underlying neuroplasticity we have. We are biological sponges. We just absorb whatever we are submerged in. And adults who think they have outgrown this are simply deceiving themselves.
Yeah.
The only difference between a child and an adult is that an adult has the agency to intentionally choose the liquid they are submerged in. If you ignore that power, you do it at your own peril.
Wow. Okay, so if our biology makes us sponges for whoever is in the room, then who we allow into the room becomes a matter of critical importance, especially when you realize how little time we actually have to give them.
Oh, the time, man.
Yeah, Spurko does this brutal breakdown of a 168-hour week that completely shatters the illusion of free time.
It's sobering. So by the time you subtract a standard 60 hours for your job, and you know that includes the actual work, the commute, the prep time, the unpaid lunch, and then you subtract 56 hours for sleep, you are left with about 52 hours.
But even that 52 hours is an illusion. Because if you are married, if you have kids, if you have a house to maintain, those family and life obligations eat up the vast majority of what remains.
Right, mowing the lawn, buying groceries, doing laundry.
Exactly. So Spurko concludes that most adults are fighting for maybe 6 to 12 hours of truly controllable free time a week.
And that scarcity is the entire point. When you only have 6 to 12 hours, the law of incrementalism becomes incredibly pronounced. Whatever you expose yourself to during those few precious hours dictates your baseline.
I look at those 12 hours like a tiny critical financial budget. If you only had a total of $10 left to invest each week, you wouldn't just throw it at a random penny stock because it was in front of you.
No, you'd be absolutely ruthless about where it went.
Right. And Spurko argues the consequences of who gets those hours are predictable. If you spend those few hours with drinking buddies, you are incrementally building a drinking issue.
Yeah.
If you spend it with broke friends who constantly dream of winning the lottery, you absorb a poverty mindset. But if you spend it with doers, you adopt get shit done credo.
Because the mechanism here is normalization. Your brain calibrates what is normal based on the data it receives during those hours. Like if everyone around you complains about their boss for 3 hours on a Friday night, your brain categorizes chronic complaining as a standard acceptable response to workplace friction.
But see, this is exactly where my coaching clients hit a wall. When I tell them they need to curate their environment, they push back hard. They say, "Isn't it cruel or elitist to ditch my struggling friends just to protect my precious 12 hours? Like, am I supposed to only hang out with millionaires who could do something for me?"
Yeah, which is such a common reaction. And Spurko completely anticipates that. He knows this law can sound intensely elitist on the surface, but he completely redefines what it means to be a true friend. And his definition has absolutely zero to do with bank accounts, net worth, or social status.
Mm-hmm.
It is entirely about character traits and mutual growth.
Yeah. Let's lay out his benchmark for a true friend, because it's actually incredibly practical. He says a true friend is someone you would willingly go on a multi-day hunting or fishing trip with, or someone you could survive a cross-country road trip with.
Which is a high bar, honestly.
It is. It's the person you would gladly offer the guest room in your home to if they were passing through town.
And to enter that specific inner circle, there is one non-negotiable requirement. They must be better than you at least one thing that you actively want to improve in yourself.
Are there one thing?
Exactly. And it is not a competition where you are keeping score. It's about finding people who naturally set a good example in an area where you are weak.
So if I'm auditing my social circle, I'm essentially assembling a personal board of directors for my character. I'm not demanding perfect people. I'm just piecing together specific traits I admire.
Precisely. And Spirko offers two contrasting examples to prove this isn't about being an elitist snob. First, he talks about a good friend of his who acts incredibly tough. You know, like, he doesn't care about anyone.
Right.
But that's just armor. In reality, this friend can meet someone once and remember four or five very specific, meaningful things about them. He would literally give you the shirt off his back. Spirko freely admits he lacks that specific trait. He can meet dozens of people and forget their names 2 hours later. So he actively wants to absorb that man's empathy and recall.
And it's not a one-way street, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
That same empathy friend sits on Spirko's back porch. They watch the ducks on Spirko's farm and they talk business. 2 days later, the friend calls to say that a unique mental framing Spirko shared during that chat just helped him close a massive deal.
Yeah, they are both trading traits. They are both a little better for knowing each other.
But the second example directly addresses your question about struggling friends. Spirko states explicitly that he has broke-ass friends who pass his inner circle test with flying colors.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Why? Because they are the kind of people who will drive 2 hours in the middle of the night to rescue you on side of the road.
Oh, okay.
They possess this fierce, unconditional loyalty. And Spirko wants that loyalty in his own DNA. They pass the standard not because they raise his financial bar, but because they raise his character bar.
Which really highlights the ultimate intentionality here. You are treating time as capital and basically buying your environment. Spirko actually talks about taking a massive six-figure pay cut earlier in his career just to take a job in internet marketing.
A six-figure pay cut?
Yes. He didn't do it for the title. He did it so he could be physically surrounded by elite marketers for 50 hours a week. He wanted to absorb their skills through sheer proximity.
Wow. He bought his environment with a pay cut.
Exactly. But this naturally leads us to the most difficult part of auditing your life. What happens when your current environment doesn't have any of those positive traits available? Like, what if you're surrounded by the wrong things?
Yeah, sometimes raising your standard requires drastic physical and social distancing. These are the truly hard choices. Let's start with the clearest boundary Spirko provides. He uses the example of a recovering addict. If you have a severe drug problem and you are genuinely serious about getting clean, you absolutely must leave your drug-losing friends.
There's no other way.
Right. If you surround an addict with drugs and users, they will use again. The biology of the environment will override their willpower. It's a choice between life, prison, or death. Most people can logically accept that extreme boundary.
Oh, for sure. The friction comes when you apply that exact same survival logic to a poverty mindset or a lack of ambition. Spirko tells a deeply personal story about his hometown of Pottsville, Pennsylvania. He states, without hesitation, that the single best decision he ever made in his life was moving away.
And he maps out the alternate reality, too. Like, if he had stayed in Pottsville, he figures he'd be an aluminum factory floor supervisor. Which, to be clear, is perfectly fine if that's your goal.
Right. There's nothing inherently wrong with that.
No. But it wasn't his goal. Because he left, he designed optical networks, created companies, and consulted for Fortune 500 brands. None of that happens if he stays submerged in his original environment.
And he realized how deeply entrenched the issue was during a visit back to Pottsville in 2001. He walked into a local donut shop at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Oh, this story.
Yeah. The place is packed with unemployed people, ranging from their 20s to their 70s, and the single most common word he heard buzzing in every conversation was cheap.
Now, why is that specific word so dangerous? Because Spirko considers it practically profane.
Because it reveals a toxic mechanism. When your entire community's focus is perpetually on preserving pennies by finding the cheapest possible option, the collective brain power is not looking for ways to create value. They aren't looking to leverage time or build skills. People will trade hours of their irreplaceable life just to save $2 on a donut or a tool. It is a scarcity mindset. It is the exact opposite of how wealth and opportunity are generated. And he realized that poverty mindset was an entrenched virus infecting the entire town.
I think we really need to pause here and clarify human worth, because the author is very careful about this distinction. He is not saying these are bad people.
No, not
they aren't stupid or malicious. They are the salt of the earth. Mm-hmm. He mentions a man named Buddy Shoemaker as an example of the good, strong community bonds that exist there. You know, they help each other out in a bind. But, and this is the painful truth of the audit, when it comes to building wealth, creating businesses, or designing an extraordinary life, that specific environment is toxic.
Right. It's completely incompatible with his goals, which is why distancing is sometimes the only viable strategy. When discussing young people trapped in depressed environments, Spurko echoes Horace Greeley's famous advice, "Go west, young man." He means you have to physically go to where the opportunity, the good economies, and the new networks are.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second, because I hear this from young leaders all the time. Can't you just stay? Like, can't you be the beacon of light in your own hometown and lift everyone up? Why run away from your roots?
It's a highly romantic, noble thought. It really is. But practically, a 19-year-old surrounded by a community-wide poverty consciousness is simply not equipped to be an agent of change.
This virus is too strong.
The environmental virus will consume them first. They must first leave, build a robust new network, acquire capital and skills, and become successful outside that ecosystem. In fact, Spurko notes that outsiders are often the only true agents of change in depressed towns, specifically because they bring a fresh vision that hasn't been beaten down by four generations of collective surrender.
Man, that's powerful.
Yeah.
So you have to go to the opportunity, a job offer, a booming city. He mentions college as a traditional route to a new network, but he throws in a very sharp warning.
Yeah.
You have to evaluate that degree path carefully.
Oh, yeah.
Because taking on $80,000 to $150,000 in student debt just to change your zip code is a massive risk.
Yeah.
That could probably be leveraged in much more efficient ways.
Definitely. The overarching goal is deliberate movement. Move, make new connections, and build a solid network. Which actually brings us to the operational core of this chapter.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you actually filter the people you meet once you've moved? Spurko provides a highly practical mental framework called the friend method.
Let's give this the time it deserves, because this is the blueprint for the audit.
Mm.
The F stands for find what you want to improve,
and
this requires brutal, uncomfortable honesty.
It really does.
You have to admit your darkness and your weaknesses.
Mm.
Do you lack discipline? Are you impatient? Is your financial sense a disaster? I always compare this step to doing a painful house inspection. You can't just go out and buy new furniture or, you know, find new friends until you accurately measure the structural weaknesses of your own house.
That analogy perfectly illustrates the mechanism. If your house inspection reveals a cracked foundation in your financial discipline, you don't go looking for a friend who is a brilliant interior decorator.
Right.
Meaning you don't look for someone who is just fun at parties and knows how to have a good time. You desperately need to find someone whose financial foundation is made of reinforced concrete so you can study how they poured it. Which brings us to R, recognize it in others.
But the key here is to look for people who live the trait, not just talk about it on social media. You want the person who quietly manages their investments, not the guy constantly bragging about his crypto wallet.
Big difference. Once you recognize it, you move to I, invest time with them. Treat your 6 to 12 hours of free time as investment capital. And the beauty of this is that Spurko emphasizes this doesn't require asking them to be your formal mentor.
Oh, thank goodness, yeah.
You don't need a curriculum. You just share experiences. You go fishing. You grab coffee. You absorb their habits organically through proximity.
Which inevitably leads to the hardest step of the audit. Eve, eliminate or reduce negative influence. If someone constantly pulls you down, drains your energy, or reinforces the exact weaknesses you are trying to fix, you need distance.
Yeah.
But how do we actually do that without creating a massive dramatic fallout?
Well, Spurko is very clear on this. Not hate, just distance. You do not need to call a town hall meeting. You don't burn bridges or make some self-righteous speech about how you were growing, and they aren't.
Oh, please don't do that.
Exactly. You simply enact the fade-out. You become busier. You politely decline the Friday night drinks because you are prioritizing those precious 12 hours elsewhere. You stop letting their behavior shape your baseline.
Because nature abhors a vacuum. When you reduce the negative, you create space for N.
Mm-hmm.
Normalize higher standards.
Yeah.
Whatever you are consistently around becomes your new normal.
Exactly.
If you intentionally surround yourself with people who solve problems instead of complaining about them, problem solving becomes your default neurological response.
Mm-hmm.
Your baseline shifts up.
And finally, the step that keeps this from being purely selfish, do the same for them. This entire ecosystem must be a two-way street. You have to be the person who sharpens others in return. You must hold yourself to a high standard, show up when it matters, and offer your own unique strengths to the group. When everyone does this, the growth compounds for the entire circle.
It is a complete paradigm shift for how you view your social calendar.
Yeah.
It turns hanging out into a subtle, powerful form of mutual evolution. And for those listening who want to dive deeper into these concepts, evaluate their own networks, and find more resources on these laws, you can find everything at jackslaws.com.
Yeah, and to ensure these concepts actually stick, Spirko ends the chapter by providing literal mental programming. It's designed like computer code to help you overwrite your old default social habits.
Yes, and I want to deliver those three final mental code lines exactly as they are written in the text. Listen closely and let this sink in. Computer is a bear. In every situation, ask who I know that handles this well and ask how they would handle it. Computer sigh. I need to spend my time with people who raise my standards. Computer limit my time with people who reinforce my weaknesses.
If we truly accept the biological reality that we become the average of the people we spend our time with, this raises a vital, immediate question for you to mull over today. Take out your phone and look at the last five people you texted. Based on everything in this chapter, ask yourself not just who they are, but who they are actively turning you into.
That is a phenomenal, uncomfortable question to end on, because when you finally sit down to audit your own relationships, you must ensure the people in your room are building your foundation, not quietly dismantling it. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Chapter 16. And as a final reminder, you can explore all of this further and access more tools by visiting jackslaws.com.